Today is the second Sunday in our series on Confucius, Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad. And three of these ancient sages, Confucius, Jesus, and Muhammad, came from very humble beginnings and yet rose to greatness. The Buddha was the notable exception. He was the only one of the four sages who started out his life with everything you could possibly want and gave it all up. So he was born Siddhartha Gautama in the year 490 approximately, before the Common Era, about 13 years or so before Confucius died. So there was a little bit of overlap there. He was born in present-day Nepal, and he lived to the age of 80. And the legend has it that his parents were fabulously wealthy king and queen, and that Siddhartha was born a prince. So he was raised in a luxurious household and given every advantage you could want. Well, his father wanted Siddhartha to someday be a great king, and so he heeded the advice of an astrologer who gave him this caution. He told the father that he should shield his son from anything distressing or unpleasant, lest the soft-hearted Siddhartha renounce the crown and decide to become a holy man, which of course is exactly what happened. But in any event, the father took that to heart, and so Siddhartha's parents raised him in a very shielded, sheltered environment. They surrounded him with only youth and beauty. They gave him constant entertainment and only the finest foods. Well, Siddhartha grew up to be uncommonly handsome. But you can tell from that, can't you? It was about 6 feet tall. He had coal black hair. He was said to have a golden complexion. And it was reported that he had a sort of godlike countenance and form. He was also reputed to be a very gifted athlete and to have a brilliant mind. Well, at the age of 16, he married a beautiful princess, Yasodhara, who gave birth to their son, Rahula. And it would seem that at a very young age, Siddhartha had it all. But in his late 20s, he began to feel restless from this life of ease and indulgence, and he decided to venture out beyond the palace walls. He made four journeys into the surrounding area, and the sights he saw became known as the four signs. The first three things he saw were an old man, a sick person, and a corpse. Well, he was greatly disturbed by these sights, especially when his chariot driver informed him that someday those things would happen to him too. Well, of course, he felt compassion for the people that he witnessed, but what really gave him that jolt was realizing that aging and death elude no one. They happen to everyone, no exceptions, including him. Well, on his fourth journey outside of the palace, he encountered a wandering ascetic called a Samana who was looking for truth. And Siddhartha noticed that even though this ascetic was living in poverty, had really nothing to his name, that he seemed serene and happy. And so right then, Siddhartha decided to leave his luxurious life in the palace, to leave his wife and child behind, to leave all of those luxuries, to walk away from all of it in order to search for the meaning of life. At the age of 29, in what is now known as the Great Renunciation, Siddhartha walked away from his life of privilege forever. And then he joined up with five of those ascetics. And these were extreme ascetics, and they believed their aim was actually to bring their flesh as close to death as possible through fasting and not bathing. So over time, Siddhartha's body changed such that he described it as looking like a skeleton covered in decaying flesh. And we can guess that the smell was pretty bad too. So living this existence and encountering all this, we might well imagine that he began to think, maybe this wasn't such a great idea after all. Because after all, he was nearing death. He had not experienced the sublime peace that he was after, or really any spiritual benefits. And so he decided that in the same way he had renounced his life of pleasure, he would now renounce his life of pain. And he began to eat normally again, because he knew he had to keep his body healthy if he would continue in his spiritual search. And the five ascetics that he was hanging out with saw him take a meal, and they left him, figuring that he had given up on his path to enlightenment. Well, now on his own, Siddhartha remembered something that he used to do as a small boy that would help relieve boredom and restlessness. He would notice his breath. He would just bring his attention over and over again to his breathing. And so he decided he would try that technique again. Near a little town called Gaya, he found a very pleasant area near a quiet, clear river and sat down beneath a peepul or fig tree. And he vowed that he would stay beneath that tree until he had a complete awakening. Even if he died in the process, he would not leave from underneath that tree. And that tree later became known as the Bodhi or the Bo tree, which represents wisdom, or more literally, wakefulness. Well, as soon as Siddhartha sat underneath that tree and began his meditation, all hell broke loose in his own mind. Have you ever experienced that when you sat down for meditation? So it is reported that all throughout the night, he was bombarded with all manner of torments and temptations, these demonic forces bringing up representations of death and fear and desire, and then discontentment and excitement and craving, all this raging inside of his mind, trying to throw him off course. Nevertheless, he persisted. He continued on steadfast. He remained open and aware, noticing these things happening in his consciousness, but not latching onto them, not resisting them. And in that way, the inner demons passed. And as he continued to sit there, his mind began to expand, and he began to have greater insights into the human condition and the nature of reality. And then, just as the morning star rose in the sky right before dawn, Siddhartha realized that he had experienced that supreme state of sublime peace that he had always been seeking, that he had indeed had a direct experience of ultimate truth. And henceforth, he became known as the Buddha. The Buddha means the one who has awakened. Well, a week or so later, he made the decision that he would share these truths that he had discovered, and his first five disciples were those ascetics who had left him when he took a simple meal on the ascetic path. And he, as the Buddha then, began teaching. He taught for a few weeks, from a few weeks after his enlightenment, which is said to occur at the age of 35, until his death at the age 80. And during those 45 years, he taught thousands of people of all ages, backgrounds, occupations, genders, stations in life, all levels of education. And people were said to have been transformed simply by being in his presence. Well, the sole objective of his teaching was to end suffering. He was less interested in talking about metaphysical ideas like the nature of reality, the way of the world, or how the universe came into being, than in helping people wake up. He wanted us to know that the things we crave cannot possibly give us the kind of satisfaction and happiness that we truly want. Indeed, our constant craving, our insatiability, is the root cause of our suffering. You may be familiar with these. The Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths that became foundational to Buddhism. And the first is that suffering is an inescapable part of life. It is a product of our unenlightened existence, our unawakened consciousness, if you will. He said that we suffer because we fail to accept that everything is impermanent, especially that which we call the self. Indeed, God is a river, that all is a river. Instead, we crave and grasp for what we think will make us happy. But there is a way out of this suffering. The Buddha actually spoke of a river with nirvana, or absolute peace, on the far shore. And the near shore consisted of the material world, the constant cycle of suffering. And his dharma, or his teachings, were the means for crossing the river to the other shore. And the key to overcoming the suffering is to cultivate wisdom and compassion. And I'm sure you've experienced this yourself. As you become more compassionate, you also grow in wisdom. Ultimately, as he showed from his own life, our best selves emerge not from trying to escape life's tough realities, but by facing and accepting them. So the Buddha taught a framework for awakening called the Noble Eightfold Path, or the Middle Way. It was called the Middle Way because it was between the extremes. I love the way his life just illustrates this all so perfectly. The Middle Way was between the extremes of indulgence and austerity. And the Eightfold Path, I guess that's probably pretty hard for you to see, but it encompasses mind, body, and spirit, right understanding or right view, right thought, or right intentions, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, and right concentration. The Buddha also emphasized moral behavior. He taught five precepts for wholesome action: refraining from harming sentient beings, refraining from stealing and coveting, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from lies and false speech, and refraining from using substances that impair the mind or body. What a different world we would live in if that prevailed. Interesting. How different we would be. People often ask whether the Buddha believed in God. And if you mean a monotheistic, anthropomorphic, supreme being God, the answer is no. But if by God you mean an ultimate transcendent reality, an ineffable absolute beyond our comprehension, the answer was probably yes. His functional equivalent to our idea, or this alternative idea of God, was nirvana, which was pure peace. You know, there's a lot to appreciate about the Buddha and about Buddhism, and there are some notable similarities to unity, if you haven't noticed them already. Our ideas about God are pretty well aligned. Buddha nature, which is described as the natural perfection of the luminous mind, sounds a lot like we would describe as our innate divinity, or even the Christ within. In unity, we teach the law of mind action, that we create our reality by the thoughts we choose to think. And similarly, the Buddha taught that our mind either traps us in an endless cycle of suffering or sets us free. Like the Buddha, we believe that direct experience is the best teacher, which is why we integrate so much meditation and prayer into our spiritual practice. And finally, we agree with the Buddha that knowing the truth is not enough. We must embody it. We must live it. You know, many Unity ministers embrace Buddhism, and quite often if you go into a Unity church, you will see a representation of the Buddha, either a statue or something else. I actually have one in my office in the back, because there is so much overlap between them. And my good friend, Reverend Elizabeth Mora, who's a Unity minister, has been here a couple of times. She actually wrote an article for Unity magazine once called, "I Am a Buddha Christian." She had found a way to integrate those two paths into her spirituality. And you know, I can really relate to that. I can really appreciate that. For a while in the 1990s, I stepped away from Unity. I began attending a sangha, a Buddhist community, which we would have what were called Dharma dialogues with a Buddhist teacher named Catherine Ingram. And I absolutely loved it. I loved the conversations, and I learned so much. And what I particularly learned, a few things stood out for me. One of them, it was so clear the way we create our own suffering. We truly do create our own suffering. We know this in unity, but in Buddhism, you really get a little clear on the fact that we do that in a couple of ways. One is by resisting what is, by not accepting what is, and going on from there. So rather than having the reaction of, oh no, not this, the reaction, the preferred reaction is now this. Oh, now this. Now what? Now what? Where do I go from here? And if you look at any time, I know it's true in my life, anytime I'm suffering or struggling with something, I can look into that and pretty much see something I'm resisting. It shouldn't be this way. This should be different. That shouldn't happen. This shouldn't have happened, correct? When we come to acceptance, we begin to discover peace. And the second thing that really stood out for me was this idea of craving, always craving more. Isn't that just so endemic to our society, to our culture, to our economy, even to us? Always believing that something outside of us will bring us happiness, whatever that might be, this idea of more, 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 and yet we're never satisfied. Well, of course we're not, the Buddha would say, because happiness doesn't come from transient things. They come and go. The happiness lies behind those transient things. And I began to see how much we attach to objects, to things, to people, to work, to whatever it is, as who we are, believing that is who we are, and forgetting who we truly are, which is none of those attachments. To my favorite line from Catherine Ingram, the Buddhist teacher I used to listen to, was this one, which I have said multiple times here. Freedom is in knowing yourself as the clearing in which everything is allowed to arise and pass. Freedom is in knowing yourself as the clearing. You are the clearing. You are the spaciousness. You are the consciousness in which everything is allowed to arise and pass. And didn't the Buddha just demonstrate that so beautifully throughout his life? You know, at the end of his life, he began to feel the effects of aging. He was afflicted by some serious illnesses. His final illness seems to have either been dysentery or food poisoning. And despite intense pain, he faced it with full awareness and complete calm. Lying down between two sala trees with his monks and nuns gathered around him, he asked three times if they had any lingering questions about the Dharma, about his teachings. Three times, there was silence. And satisfied, he uttered his final words. All conditioned things are impermanent. Strive for liberation with diligence. And then he peacefully passed into death. You know, what an incredible example he set for us, and in a way, what a daunting challenge to accept what is, no matter what. You know, if we are to stop resisting what is, I'm not saying we don't try to change things for the better. I'm not saying we don't take mindful action, but we start from what is instead of resisting what is. In order to stop resisting, we have to be willing to release and let go. We got to stop clinging. Now release the white knuckle grip. In order to release and let go, we need to know that we're going to be okay if we do. And we will be okay. In fact, we'll be more than okay. Because behind all of our material, impermanent things that come and go, behind our cravings and our grasping, behind the impermanence of all that is in our material life, there is indeed a vast, infinite ocean field of love, and peace, and oneness. It is the infinite, absolute truth of what is. The Buddha believed very strongly, made it clear that we all have access to that realm of consciousness, and I have bedrock faith that that consciousness is available to all of us, that higher realm and awareness, that awakened consciousness is available to each and every one of us, and I hope that you do too. And so let each of us continue on our spiritual journey, each in our own way, until we discover that nirvana for ourselves. Let's turn now to our meditation. With The Buddha encouraged various meditative practices for different purposes. Now, there's one meditation in particular that has become very popular in Western Buddhism, and it is called the Metta, or loving kindness meditation. Its purpose being transformation of thought. So let's experience it now. I invite you to close your eyes, get comfortable in your seat. And just as the Buddha did when he was a small boy, and later as an adult, focus on your breath. Feel the air coming in, the air going out, and the still space in between. Breathing in the essence of God, of Spirit, and releasing any worries, concerns, fears, or busy thoughts. And I invite you to address this meditation first to yourself, repeating within your own mind and heart. May I be happy. Repeat it in your own mind after I say it. May I be free from illness. May I be free from suffering. May I be free from fear. May I be contented. May I be at peace. And breathe. And now, thinking of someone you dearly love, again, repeat these affirmations, these prayers, holding them in your heart and mind. May you be happy. May you be free from illness. May you be free from suffering. May you be free from fear. May you be contented. May you be at peace. Now think of someone you hardly know, maybe someone you pass here at church, or a stranger you occasionally see, someone at the store, maybe a mere acquaintance. Bring them to your mind as you say in your heart. May you be happy. May you be free from illness. May you be free from suffering. May you be free from fear. May you be contented. May you be at peace. Now think of someone you may consider to be an adversary, someone for whom you may harbor ill feelings, a grudge, unforgiveness. Bring them to mind. Bring them into your heart as you say, may you be happy. May you be free from illness. May you be free from suffering. May you be free from fear. May you be contented. May you know peace. now feeling your heart so full and expanding. Think of all beings and all of life and hold in your heart. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free from illness. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be free from fear. May all beings be contented. May all beings know peace. Take a moment now to feel that unity with all beings and all of life in the silence. Give thanks for the knowing that truly we are one, and that as we send out these prayerful blessings to others around us and to ourselves, they make a difference. We are grateful for this knowing, for this truth. We are grateful to our way showers. And today we are grateful to the great Buddha. Thank you, sweet spirit. We continue on from here, and so it is. Amen. Say in Buddhism, Namaste.